It's time for the PowerMizzou.com podcast with interviews and analysis of your Missouri Tigers. Now, here's your host, Gabe DeArmond.
Welcome back to another week of the PowerMizzou.com podcast. Missouri does play Mississippi State tomorrow. We've previewed that all week, but honestly, we're a little short week, so we're going a different way with the podcast this week. We are welcoming in a former Tiger. That is Nick Berardini, who is going to talk some about Mizzou athletics and some about what he's doing now. And, Nick, we're going to give you the choice. Do you want to talk about what you're doing now first, or do you want to tell stories about Mizzou basketball first?
I need a second to get liquored up to tell stories about Mizzou basketball, so we'll maybe save that for the end. That way, you know, the people that are actually interested in listening have to sit through my promotional stuff.
I got you.
Before we get to the fun stuff. Sure, yeah.
We do have minimum a dozen people who listen on a regular basis, and this is the first open admission there is drinking on the podcast, which is not true, but sounds cool.
They all need to buy a ticket, too. That's $120 that they can put in my pocket. So those 12 people better show up to buy a ticket.
There you go. Good deal. Now, Nick played basketball for Missouri a few years ago, but since then, documentary filmmaker. I mean, I'll just let you kind of fill people in, you know, what you've done and honestly, how you got into it.
Yeah, I was, I grew up, you know, most people don't know this about me, but I grew up as a child model actor star. I single-handedly put Montgomery Ward out of business because they paid me so much for their print catalog work. And I actually started to get marginally good at sports, you know, around 13 or 14 and kind of just wanted to pursue that more. And, you know, it helped that I finally grew up and wasn't cute anymore. So that damaged my prospects of child modeling. And so I put that on the back burner. But ever since I can remember, I've been into films. I've been into filmmaking. I knew at a certain point in the back of my head, there was a stretch where I was thinking, you know, maybe coaching would be fun. Maybe that makes sense. But then, you know, as we can discuss, that seemed like the only thing crazier than trying to be a filmmaker would be going into coaching. So I took, you know, the lesser of two evils and really got back into writing and filmmaking and that sort of stuff my senior year of college. And just coincidentally was a broadcast major. We didn't have they have a documentary program now. They have a film school. We didn't have those things when I was a student. Or, you know, the film school wasn't as prevalent as it is now. And my news director, Stacey Wolfel at KOMU, who now is the director of the documentary program, was covering the story about this kid who died in Moberly in a traffic stop. And he said, why don't you make a movie? You want to get into filmmaking? Don't move to L.A. like an idiot. Just start making a movie. And it ruined my life for quite some time. But, yeah, eventually became worth it.
Well, the only thing actually worse than both of those things, and I say this as a fellow broadcast major, would have been to go into broadcast news.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Right. You know, well, you maybe can afford two extra value meals a month. Broadcast news can afford one.
I want to be poor, but I don't want to be unemployed. That's
exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And I mean, the film you made, Tom Swift and His Electric Rifle, just kind of tell people, you know, that was your debut, right?
Yes, yeah. So actually, it's a funny story. It's called Killing Them Safely Now, and there's a great reason behind this. This will give you a little insight into how, you know, the small-time movie business works. The movie title, Tom Swift and His Electric Rifle, started as the acronym. It's the acronym for the Taser, and the movie's about this company that invented the Taser and these two brothers that perfected it and became massively successful, you know, with a lot of collateral damage in their wake. And it's really a fascinating look at anti-heroes, because even though they do things that turn out to be morally dubious, they're also not just bad guys. They're complicated people and characters, and that's why the film is a film and not just like a crappy thesis statement, you know. But we call it Tom Swift and His Electric Rifle because it's the acronym for the Taser, but it's also, it means, you know, to us that the inventor is the good guy. And the original inventor, Jack Cover, was inspired by this old novel by Victor Appleton, where Tom Swift was this adolescent kid, kind of like the first young adult novel series. Mm-hmm. And one of the books was he invents this electric rifle that can subdue people safely. And the two brothers that worked with the original inventor to perfect it were Star Trek geeks. And all the whole thing spoke to, like, they're doing what they think is right because they think technology can save us. Mm-hmm. And so I give this long, you know, eloquent explanation of the title to the distributor, IFC, and they're like, yeah, nobody cares. Nobody cares about that. We just want to put people in the theater, so, like, let's be provocative. Mm-hmm. And so we went back to what was originally the very first title, Killing Them Safely, which is fine. I don't get to make that call, and, you know, it's all right.
Hey, take me through, I mean, you started this. You said Stacy, you know, said make a movie. You go into this, is your thought, I don't know what this is about, and I want to find out. I want to make some sort of a political statement. I mean, what's your approach going in?
Yeah, my approach going in, first of all, as a bad filmmaker back then, is arrogance. Is this is gonna be easy, you know? We'll deal with this, and then I'll get to the cool movies later. No, in all seriousness, what inspired it was this. I had become really close with this kid's family. And I began making the movie about Moberly and how it had become fractured over what had happened and how the officers were clearly at fault and aggressive, but they still had to be assimilated back into the community. And I'm fascinated. That's part of why I'm fascinated by the law enforcement discussion today, because I'm a firm believer, and this comes through in the film, that, you know, the moral standard is not always set by the individual, it's set by the environment. And that question of why did this happen to this kid on the surface seemed very simple, seemed these aggressive police officers wanted to mess with him during a traffic stop because he was giving them crap, you know, and they used this weapon and they killed him. But it was the fundamental understanding of what they were doing and the consequences of that action. And then seeing the dash cam footage, listening to his mother, who, you know, he's in this traffic stop right outside of his home, listening to his mother screaming for help as they think he's faking it. You know, how does it, what are the depths that get to that point, that moment where in 30 seconds, you know, everybody's lives change forever. That was the catalyst. That was why did this happen to him? And it eventually led me to this company, which asks a lot of the same questions, you know, asks the question, not just, and this is the way I explain journalism versus filmmaking, is journalism is oftentimes a practice of information, of what, and filmmaking has more breadth than that if you're good at it. You know, you can get more into the psychology of why. And in this instance, that became the movie. Is we're at this doorstep now, and how did it lead to a dead kid in Moberly, basically?
I mean, I know what the critical reception has been. I guess maybe explain the difference for idiots like me in what you're doing versus the movie I might go pay $8 to see at Hollywood Theater. It's obviously a different audience, and I would assume a different goal going in.
Yeah, you know, well, the first thing is, though, that I don't, and why I don't just want to make documentaries, or why I don't just want to make documentaries, because, again, while I don't think I'm a journalist, I'm definitely, there's journalism in the movie. There's, you know, there's ethical and honest reporting in the movie. It's just, it's not through of the voice of the reporter. It's it's through characters. It's through a different context. So I still am fascinated by that and want to work in that environment, in that space, but I also want to be a filmmaker. I eventually want to direct the crappy $100 million movie that you'll see at Hollywood Theater. And so for me, this was more a statement of for me personally as a filmmaker, it's more a statement of my point of view, of how I see the world, and that I have an interesting point of view that can then translate itself to multiple different projects, which, you know, I've already started some new ones. And the great thing about the success of this is that while, you know, I've gotten a lot of great attention for it, I'm certainly still very poor, and I got married to avoid being poor, but it's leading to a lot of new opportunities because I think people can see that I'm somebody who has an interesting voice.
My wife got married to avoid being poor, and it did not work out well for her.
We need to get more than dozens of listeners.
Yes, exactly. It mentioned a little bit kind of the critical reception, and when we were talking briefly beforehand, you can tell me, you know, how much that means and all that, but reception has been, I mean, has garnered quite a bit of attention.
Yeah, that's really rewarding to see, you know, because we ruin our lives as filmmakers to do a lot of these things, especially your first one, because what you have to know about the movie business in America, as opposed to, you know, a lot of other social welfare states where there's funding for the arts, you know, it's a good and bad scenario, because the bad of it is it's very hard to get funding. The good of it is you become so sharp and such an entrepreneur and you know, you have to become an excellent filmmaker to convince anybody to give you the money that you need, not just to live while making the project, I mean, to actually physically go make it. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, the vicious cycle is that you can't make a movie without really having made one before, because that's the point. You have to convince people, mm-hmm. you know, your stuff will right. get watched. And so that challenge of how do I sharpen myself and pitch myself in a way that's going to get people to take a chance on me, is really difficult and took a lot of practice. And in documentaries, it's access. Once we demonstrated we have access to this phenomenal story, that's like your script. That's really when you can take something whole to a production company, which is what we ended up doing, and get them to buy in on that. So it's also great that, you know, it's very rewarding that critically everybody gets the movie, because that's a concern when you're making issue films. If you don't prove a thesis, you know, and then like when you're making an issue film, oftentimes it's like, give me a thesis and prove it. And that's a stupid way of filmmaking.
Right.
And I'm glad that this different way that's more unique, that's more three-dimensional than that, is being embraced and recognized as such, because that's a concern.
In other words, you don't start a story knowing, I want the story to say this before I talk to anybody.
Yeah, it's not a position paper. It's not mm-hmm. it's not a movie about, are tasers good or bad? That's a stupid question in my mind, because like, that question might have been relevant 15 years ago before 100, you know, 1,000 police departments in the world are right. using these things or whatever. You know, there's 500,000 police officers in the United States using them. But it's a question, you know, so since it's a retroactive look at this issue as a broader issue, it's not necessarily a commentary, like I was saying, about are tasers good or bad. It's a commentary about the way in which we define good and bad, and mm-hmm. the way that it's easy to manipulate that environment to your own self-interest, and then be able to sleep at night, and then be able to say, well, the ends justify the means. And that's, you know, not to brag too much of myself, but that's good filmmaking. That's yeah. not just, well, these are bad and this is what we should do about it. Because, you know, the last thought about, are these good or bad? Well, let's say that my position was we should pull these weapons away from 500,000 police officers. It would make the exact same mistake that the company made in the beginning by revolutionizing policing using the weapon. They overnight almost changed the way police officers did their jobs. Well, if we said, let's pull these off the streets because of the way they're trained, because it did revolutionize the way they do mm-hmm. their job, it's going to fundamentally cause chaos, because they've been trained based on using this as a safe weapon. It's just too complicated to say, are they good or bad? They need awareness, basically.
So if people go see this film, and we'll talk about where they can and how they can in a minute, but is your hope that they walk out thinking something specific, or just that they walk out thinking?
Yeah, it's. I want them to see what I love about documentaries, and I definitely want to make narrative films one day. I want to make fiction films or based on true story, even films. But the thing about documentary is these are real people. The film is very respectful of everyone as a human being. And in fact, part of the way it builds its narrative trajectory, it builds towards tasers successful, and then they have these lawyers who are their adversary, and there's a lot of deposition footage where they're sort of snippy with each other, and all these things are going on. And what gets lost in the shuffle is what they're analyzing are numbers on a page. How many people die? What's the cost-benefit analysis of this, right? For the company, it was very clear. They needed that collateral damage because the weapons were so expensive that unless they could convince all these police officers that they were safe, nobody would buy them, because they would be a niche weapon. If they were safe, they could be used in a variety of contexts. Well, in those contexts, if it can kill someone, then people whose lives shouldn't be in jeopardy are going to die.
Right.
But now we're doing an analysis of how many times are they used, how many people have died. But it's about people. I mean, at the end of the day, like, that's still somebody who's dead. That's a person. That's a person. You know, the guys making the weapons, they're people. And so what I want people kind of thinking about and understanding is how easy it is to be corrupted by, you know, the best version of ourselves. And that self-interest isn't just on the part of the guys running the company. It's also like the lawyers who I love dearly, you know, they're not sitting in those rooms thinking they're going to lose the case. They're sitting in the rooms like, we're going to probably win a few million bucks.
Right.
You know, they're not taking cases they're going to lose. And the police officers are not doing a job, you know, based on like, I just can't wait to go out there and screw with somebody. There, a lot of them are doing a job based on self-interest, based on I want to be the best officer that I can be. And so that's what I want them reflecting on is how do our own situations cause us to think about right and wrong based on the circumstances that we're in.
Talking with Nick Berardini this week, and hey, I will apologize for raising the level of intellect on this podcast in advance. I mean, normally we're talking about will or will Missouri not manage to cross that little white line at the end of the football field.
But I could talk about that all day. I could talk about it all day.
You were saying, though, beforehand that, listen, a lot of this critical acclaim, ultimately these things are out to make money, to get people to see them. So people that either are interested in this topic or are Missouri fans, remember you, want to support what you're doing, where do they go see this? How do they kind of help out?
Well, what's really special is that we got a really good distribution deal with a very legitimate distributor. And what they've allowed us to do is before it goes nationwide, we're doing a sneak preview screening at the Missouri Theater on November 18th. Because Mid-Missouri is the catalyst for the film, and Moberly, what happened to Stanley Harlan, is the catalyst for the film. It's important for me to share this work with this community specifically. And so that's going to be great. That's November 18th at 7:30. Then after that, it'll be available. It comes out in theaters November 27th, and it'll be available on iTunes and Google Play and all those platforms around the same time. And then, you know, if you really want to, screw me over because I don't get too much of a say in this, you could watch it on Netflix, I'm sure.
Okay.
Sometime starting next summer.
I'm interested how much of this, like, I know if you write a book, you better be out there pushing that book, and you're doing book signings and all that. So how much of, hey, we get it in this theater and we get it here and there, how much of that do you have to do? And are you now a business person as much as a filmmaker? And how much are these people that maybe you're working with?
My job is hard, but it's relatively simple now. It's just sound smart and point people in the right direction. You know,
yeah.
I'm very good at sounding smart. I'm not actually very smart. So it's mostly all promotional. It's mostly about, you know, how do we convince audiences? For example, the distributor will say, where does it make sense to play this film? Mm-hmm. And another important caveat is that there's a difference between screening a film for a week in a theater, which is very difficult to make money, which we'll do in several cities where it's called a run, basically,
right,
a theatrical run, versus also doing like what we're doing in Columbia on the 18th, on November 18th, is a one-off screening, an event-based screening where you're pretty sure you can fill the seats. You're pretty sure that per screen average is going to be really high. So that's challenging, is we need to find places where we know we have to have at least a week-long run to qualify for certain awards. For example, the Academy Awards, you have to play theatrically at least a week in New York and in L.A. That's fine. People go to the movies in New York and L.A. But where else does it make sense for us to do that? You know, is San Francisco a community that's had a lot of controversy that makes sense because people are just have a vested interest? As the expert in this subject matter, I help with determining it makes sense to play in these places. But as a marketer, for example, like, I have very little input. They're like, look, your nuanced take on, you know, two brothers starting a company,
right,
like, that's great. You get to be the director, but we're just going to cut a trailer that looks big and scary. So, like, people go watch it, you know?
Good enough. Kind of like all the movies that I think look really funny, and then I saw all those lines in that commercial.
Except those are bad. This movie's better than the trailer.
Okay, good
so,
deal.
Yeah.
A couple more on this subject, and then as I know you are able and willing to do, you can riff on Missouri sports a little bit. First of all, the thing in Missouri Theater, how you pre-selling tickets already? Mm-hmm. How do people get them, or can they get them anymore?
Yeah, so you can buy tickets on the True False website.
It's
a screening sponsored by both True False and the University of Missouri. And so you can buy tickets on the True False website. We'll be doing a ton of promotional stuff. It'd be really great too if people went to our Facebook page and like our Facebook page. Even people that, it's important to also note that seem, maybe they're skeptical about this film because they think it's not a, you know, it's an attack on law enforcement or something. And that's not really it at all. When you see the film, you'll understand what I mean. It's very thoughtful about law enforcement. So like our Facebook page, Killing Them Safely, and I post a lot of updates from that. I still actually do run the Facebook page, not the distributor. But I'll, believe me, be providing plenty of links for people to go online and buy tickets. And it would be, you know, it would be really special to have a great crowd that night.
What's the reception been from, have the people involved, you know, whether it's the family, the officers, whatever, seen it? And what was the response from them?
Yeah, the people, so everybody involved from the side of, not from the company, let's say, has seen the film. And the family especially, it's very, very important and meaningful for them, because even though they're a smaller piece than they initially were, they're a significant piece. And part of the frustration when someone dies in police custody for these families is they tend to feel, I think, like they're not being listened to. And the film, I think, represents their frustration, even though it's, again, they're not in a ton of it. It represents the frustration of what they must feel now, continuing to live their lives after this devastating incident. The company, I'm sure, in some way has seen the film because it's played enough festivals. I'm sure they've sent somebody to it. but they are taking a very cautious approach. Their stock, for example, just went down 10% yesterday. Now, some of that has to do with body camera issues and the fact that they're getting hammered because they charge so much money for storage fees and all these things. Short sellers are really good at what they do on Wall Street. But some of it is definitely also the buildup to this release. And I think their strategy is, let's not touch this with a 10-foot pole until it becomes absolutely necessary. Steve Tuttle, who's the vice president of communications at Taser, has responded one time in a Newsweek article because it was Newsweek. And he, you know, it's hard to no comment Newsweek. Otherwise, it's pretty much been no comment.
Okay, now, this is your first film. You said you were talking about, you know, hoping to get involved with some other projects. So what's next? Has the door kind of opened a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, I mean, I can't divulge all the secrets of Hollywood to everybody. I mean, you guys, you know, this is a real treat for your dozen listeners. You know, they get a real inside scoop. No, I'm working on several things, a couple of them are also have local elements to them, and they're really exciting, both fiction and nonfiction stuff. In the meantime, too, I'm directing some commercials, and you know, mostly again, just focused on continuing to form a unique point of view.
One more, I did want to ask you on this side. I remember at one point, shoot, it feels like maybe a year ago, probably wasn't quite that long ago, but you told me you'd gotten to meet De Niro at a film festival. Was there like an, oh my God, this is kind of real moment, whether it was that or another one?
Unfortunately, I didn't actually, I was in the same place as
Robert. Okay, but
Robert
you didn't actually meet
I was at Robert De Niro's film festival, Tribeca, and we were in the same room. Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet him. But I think the most, you know, it's not been a moment where I got to meet some cool celebrity or anything like that. It's mostly been about seeing everything all the insecurity you had, all the things you sacrificed, all the ways in which you had to struggle to figure out a way to just finish this thing, not settling for a lower brow version of what it could have been, and fighting desperately for what you believed in. Seeing that be received well is the thing that I think sort of is my out-of-body experience kind of thing.
And this podcast, I want to be clear, is like a commercial for the Missouri J School. You can either go on to make important documentaries, or you can talk about Missouri sports and work from your couch. Yeah. So, you know, this is like a two-pronged deal here, and we're going to do a little bit of that because, Nick, I know you still, I mean, like you said, you follow football. Obviously, it's basketball, and I know you're pretty self-deprecating, so you're not going to be offended if there are going to be fans out there who are going, hang on, Nick Berardini, I don't remember him from those teams necessarily, but you got your name chanted a few times in that arena when those teams would go on runs. You were the guy they wanted to see come out and hit the 30-footer.
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, had I known that, you know, my best friends on the team and Matt Lawrence, who's still my best friend in real life, they were going to figure out a way to, you know, make the Elite Eight in 2009.
Right.
I might have stuck around for that fifth year of eligibility I had, but, you know, I kind of looked at it that summer and was pretty exhausted and thought, you know what, they're going to suck anyway. So, why, you know, what's the point? And then they went and
did
won
you 31. Really think that going
no,
into that year?
No. I thought they had a good chance. And that's, it's a little bit more complicated about why I decided not to play my fifth year. And it goes back to what people don't often get a chance to appreciate about playing a sport at that level, especially someone like me who, you know, I had to work incredibly hard to compete. I was a good high school athlete, but I was except for my senior year when I got hurt and was tired and was 15 pounds heavier than I was my junior year. But I was a really good athlete, and it took, like, I was running with a 30-pound weight vest on 6 miles a day every summer, you know, like to try to just be able to run sprints with these guys. Mm-hmm. And part of that, too, was the frustration of that 2008 season and finally feeling like we were going to take a big step forward. And then, you know, everything that happened with Stefan and the Nebraska game that you're not getting a chance to play in that game. I love Mike Anderson very, very much. In the moment, it's harder to understand how much that impacts my psyche as it does. Mm-hmm. You know, he's trying to win a game, and I totally respect that. But it was really hard for me, having done all the right things, to sit there and not get a chance to play in that game, thinking I could help us win the game. Mm-hmm. What it was saying sort of to me, and again, this is not a dig at Mike Anderson. He's focused in the moment trying to do what he thinks he can do to win. But it was the last sort of straw for me as a guy who was exhausted, who thought, gosh, they think there's a bigger chance that if I go in for a minute, I'm going to do something that'll lose us the game than than I'm going to do something that's going to win us the game. And I disagree, you know, if I come in the game and I had already made several threes that year, if I come in the game and take a charge and make a three, like, it might change the entire complexion of the game. If I come in the game and throw the ball away, they're going to take me out and, you know, whatever, right. You know, like, and that was really one of the things as we're skipping toward the end of, you know, my career that made it difficult to justify all the work. And it didn't hit me until that summer when I was really gearing up in my journalism classes and realizing, like, I don't know if I can stomach both of these things.
Right. Well, you bring up an interesting point, and I want to ask you, and I know Jarrett Sutton pretty well and talk to him on a fairly regular basis too, had a kind of a similar role really on Missouri's next really good basketball team to what you did. And the one question I've always had, and my son is a high school athlete who has said a few times, well, if I don't get a scholarship, I'm just going to walk on somewhere. And what I always wanted to, I mean, you worked every bit as hard as Damari Carroll or anybody else on that team without really much of the glory or much of the payoff. So I've always wanted to ask guys who do that, why? Well, and was it worth it?
It was totally worth it for me. And not just because I was really popular with girls in college, but but mostly because, you know, even on, I wouldn't say every team I was on was bad, but we were never better than just pretty good. My junior year when we were 18 and 12 is the most frustrating year because we were really three or four games away that turned on a dime from making the NCAA tournament. I mean, we lost to Nebraska twice, which I don't know why Missouri can't beat Nebraska. It's I could spend hours about, like, the horrors of going to, you know, Lincoln not being able to win a game there. And we blew an 18-point lead at home the first conference game of the year to Iowa State, where Wesley Johnson hit a shot at the buzzer. And just those three games, you know, take us from 18 and 11 going into the Big 12 tournament and being in sixth place to, you know, 21 and 8 mm-hmm. and probably being in fourth place. And you know, so it was teams that mostly were either underachieving or just bad. My sophomore year, we had some good players, but we were a bad team when we were 12 and 16, but you're with your friends, you know, I mean, Matt Lawrence is one of my best friends to this day. Justin Safford is one of my best friends to this day. And there's something special, even when things aren't going well, about the camaraderie that you have with them. Like seeing Matt Lawrence, you know, his junior year at his sophomore year, at Allen Fieldhouse, you know, go in and outplay Brandon Rush. And Matt's, you know, I remember a point really early in the game where Matt hits like his third three in a row or something. And we were, I'm watching my friend at Allen Fieldhouse, you know, come into his own, really. And he gets up, Brandon Rush knocks him down, and Steve Wilmer was officiating. And Matt gets up, and he turns around, and he yells at Steve Wilmer. But he's so nervous to finally address an official for the first time in the game, his voice cracks. And he
That's
goes,
awesome.
Come on, Steve, call foul, you know. And you're looking at this, and you're like, Matt Lawrence has the balls to yell at Steve Wilmer,
right?
You know, and at the same time is going to go for like 25 tonight or whatever. It's really special to have those moments and to be a part of something that's bigger than, you know, yourself.
Really. Mm-hmm. Those years, first off, you came here under Quinn, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I've ever directly asked anybody this. For the people who were involved, I mean, I know covering it, people got mad at me, and I said, guys, I couldn't wake up and make up a story that would be this insane. Like, I know you think I'm out to get them, but this is really happening because I couldn't invent it.
Yeah.
What was it like being involved with it, with that last, you know, I don't know, 6 months?
It was surreal. That whole, starting with losing to Sam Houston State in the preseason 19, back
by the way, my most infamous Missouri basketball moment ever came when you guys come down the court, got a chance to win the game, and Jimmy McKinney goes up for a three and legitimately loses the ball over his head into the stands. Yeah. I mean, that moment to me summed up that entire season.
Yeah, that's fair. And that was in the days when you didn't just automatically get to go to New York if it was the preseason. You had to win to go. And in fairness, Drexel, who ended up advancing, was probably a better team than us. But we had this opportunity to potentially go play Duke, you know, with J.J. Redick at the preseason NIT over Thanksgiving week. My parents had already spent something like $500 on airfare and hotels in the lead up to, you know, expecting us to be there. And the Thanksgiving week where we weren't playing and there are no NCAA restrictions about practice time was one of the most epically terrible weeks of my life, because all we did was be in the gym and get just the crap kicked out of us, because you could sense the desperation. And I'm someone, and people ask me a lot about Coach Snyder, and like, I became a better player after he left. And the reason I did was not because he didn't coach me or wasn't brilliant or I didn't love him. It was because he intimidated me to such an extent, because I had this idea of Coach Snyder in my head that I would like crap myself sometimes, you know, like trying to impress him, trying to play for him. And that's how much I specifically loved him. And to also see the complication of everything that was going on, it manifested itself throughout the year, because that's what people don't understand and what I have sympathy for with guys with, like, you know, this basketball team. It's like that pressure, that idea that there's a question about whether this whole thing that you have to work through every day is going to fall apart builds upon itself. It's why it's very hard to be on the hot seat and get off the hot seat, because it's just an overwhelming amount of pressure. And then that whole season was, which, you know, we can talk about, some really, really fascinating and both like Shakespearean in so many ways.
I want to know if my thought on Quinn always has been this, and you tell me if it's off base. I've run it past a couple people involved with the program at that time, and they totally agree, but you may disagree. I said, Quinn obviously knew a ton about basketball. Mm-hmm. He was obviously an incredibly intelligent human being. At that time in his life, he apparently had no idea how to communicate what he was thinking to the level of a 19 or 20-year-old athlete.
There's a great example. My freshman year, you know, we're up 12 at Allen Fieldhouse, this is my redshirt freshman year. So we're up 12 at Allen Fieldhouse, and the entire joke after the game that I heard, you know, of guys that I was just chatting with or had made acquaintance with on press row was, when is Bill Self going to go to a zone? Because that entire team, like, we had Linus Klaza, you couldn't guard Linus Klaza man to man, and he's just out there abusing people. And Bill Self, of all guys, finally goes to a zone with like 6 minutes left. And we're up 12 and we lose by 12. And I remember sitting there, his first reaction was to check Glenn Dandridge into the game. And Glenn Dandridge came in, and what an unbelievably like talented kid.
His best practice shooter who couldn't shoot,
like,
in a game that I've ever seen.
Can't understand how good he was as a practice player and like a pickup guy. And he came in off one pass and airballed the three. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to lose this game, because we can't figure out, like, it's those kind of things, like I was saying, that manifest themselves. Like, once you have a problem beating a zone, it's now like, wait, there's no confidence that we can beat a zone. Let's check Glenn. Let's see if, and let's see if Glenn can make a shot. You know, and that's one of those things that becomes really difficult in why good coaches are so good, is because they get experience in handling the moment. And as a guy who was really young when he took the job, I don't know if he had yet figured out a way to, you know, get people to get it, because I think it has to do with youth. I think it has to do with, you know, not having lived through that moment.
Mm-hmm. You played for the two Missouri basketball coaches that now, post-career, probably, and I know it's kind of a short list. I mean, most Missouri fans aren't going to remember a coach before Norm, so it's only like a list of four or five guys, but that probably by fans are the two most disliked. I've always said Quinn was a good coach. It wasn't the right move here. Mike Anderson, I get why Missouri fans don't love him because of the way he left, but Mike Anderson was bar none the best coach this school's had since Norm.
Yeah. I was talking to my buddy Will Bartlett last night, who's on staff at Arkansas now with him, who was a manager at Mizzou when I was a player. And, you know, my point of view on it is that oftentimes, like, Missouri, I think basketball-wise, has the appropriate expectation. I don't think it's a problem of fan expectation. I don't think anybody expects that this should be a national title every year contender. Right. It's about making the tournament. It's about winning games above your pay grade every now and then. That's why Norm was so popular, because he used to be Kansas all the time, you know, and that's we recognize that as a program a little bit above our pay grade, so we love to beat him. But what had happened, I think, was even though he was then, you know, 09, 10, 11, making the tournament, the 09 team that was really, really deep. I mean, in fairness, like, that team also had Damari Carroll on it. That team had incredible players on it in retrospect, you know, that developed really well. But even the 10 team that wasn't as good, that still won a tournament game, the 11 team, it wasn't so much about failed expectation. It was the end of the 2010 season, I think, when the Oregon job was kind of leveraged out there, which I don't think, honestly, Coach Anderson even has anything to do with. I think that's a game that agents play.
That's what happens when Jimmy Sexton's your
agent. Exactly. Yeah. You get and that pisses people in Missouri off because we're a very specific type of fan base, which, you know, I like to many extents. And then you had such high expectations for the 2011 team that when they were an 11 seed and sort of faltered down the stretch, it was a question of, you know, has this run its course? In fairness to Missouri, Coach Anderson felt like he deserved elite money. Arkansas was willing to pay him elite money. Arkansas wanted to bring a guy who had, you know, sown his oats back.
Right.
And Mike Alden, I don't think, really was ready to pay Mike Anderson elite money. And that's the way that coaching works. It's not like, it shouldn't be that upsetting.
I have said since the day, and because you played for Mike, obviously you have a perspective on this, even though you weren't on the team, obviously, when he left. I said, had Mike Anderson simply walked into the media room and told us all he was leaving and answered two questions and then gone to Fayetteville, nobody holds the level. I mean, I thought Mike Anderson was going to be the Arkansas coach at some point the day he took the Missouri job. My personal, I don't want to say issue because I'm over it, but why I disagreed with it, why I think a bunch of fans did, was it seemed to be sneaking off in the night and getting assistance doing it. From your view, which is much closer than mine, but not on the team, you think that's a fair?
I think the thing that hurt was that John Pelfrey resigned or was fired, you know, in January or whatever it was. And it just snowballed. Then the endless speculation snowballed. I think that it's fair. It's a fair criticism.
And he assured us all he was coming back, even though... it's like the vote of confidence from the GM.
Right. There was so much inner turmoil. And why I was so surprised that the team the next year grew up so much and became so good, because there was a lot of inner turmoil. But I also think that it's a fair criticism to levy, but it's also like, nobody does that. Brian Kelly dipped out on Cincinnati to take the Notre Dame job, you know.
We're the media, and we expect everyone to talk to us.
You know, and like, he doesn't understand why they're mad, and I understand why they're mad, you know, but like, they're undefeated, about to go play in the Sugar Bowl, and like, he's, you know, doing a press conference in South Bend. And that's just the way it kind of works. It's an awkward thing, and it's a fair criticism, but it's also almost like not logical, you know?
Right.
It's a very weird situation that way.
One more about kind of the old times, and then I know you still follow Mizzou and want to talk to you about kind of where it's at now. But you mentioned Linus Klaza. You played with Damari. I assume it's one of those two, but who's the best player you played with?
Well, thing about the 08 team with Damari is he was, you know,
he didn't become really Damari until that next year.
Right. He was hurt most of the year. I remember having a conversation with him in August when he was, you know, in that incident where he had a bullet, you know, skip off the sidewalk and hit him in the ankle, which is one of the most terrifying phone calls I've ever received, because it's 4th of July weekend and I'm back home in Chicago, and it's 6 in the morning. I get a call from a coach. He says, you know, I'll keep everybody anonymous. But he says, yeah, Nick, you're going to need to get back to Columbia as soon as possible. Damari's been shot.
You know, and that's it, huh?
Like, so why don't you hustle back? And, you know, of course, my initial reaction to waking up to that is like, what's going on? You know, he, in fairness, they said he's okay, but, you know, I didn't know the extent of how hurt he was. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't seriously injured, but that hindered him throughout the season. He never played healthy that year because I think he was so eager to get on the court. He rushed himself back in August and September and conditioning and all those things. He was a more tenacious and reliable guy. Linus is purely probably a little more talented, but there's a reason Damari has found this role in the NBA. It's because he has a will to not only improve, but also to win every time he steps out. That was unmatched. And that made that team with Matt and Leo and Damari and these guys who had grown into this leadership role so difficult to beat because they were relentless.
Either would be welcome where Missouri stands right now. As former player, I know you guys all talk and keep in touch. You know, what's kind of the attitude of guys of where things are right now, and is there hope it's going to get better?
I think there's definitely hope. I love Kim Anderson. And this is the same thing about Quinn Snyder, too, is that I loved Coach Snyder. Mm-hmm. I think you have to – I understand the complications. I didn't have that perspective because I'm coming to practice every day. We all heard the rumors. We all heard the stories. And, like, that's not the guy that I saw, you know. And it's not my place to talk anything about that. But I see
– That was going to be my next question, unfortunately.
Well,
but no.
Well, it's very strange when your coach has to come into team meetings and, like, talk about, you know, like, all the nonsense that's being, you know, spewed about him. But what I think is so special about teams – is that you form these relationships. And for example, like the Kansas game, my sophomore year, is the last game Quinn Snyder ever won. And it's so special to me because it was a game I had a significant part in as a player, not having played the game, but we're down 9 with a minute 52 left. And I kind of like do the Will Ferrell old school debate moment where I black out in a huddle and scream at everybody. I'm grabbing guys by the jerseys like, we're going to win this game. You know, we're screaming at everybody. And I remember Coach kind of like in his own world with the assistants starting to come back to the huddle. And he like kind of lets me have this moment, you know, this like sophomore walk on is yelling at Jimmy McKinney, you know, like we're give Thomas the ball and we're going to win the game. And then after the game, Coach comes in the locker room, right? And he used to call me Bernie. I think he knew my last name, but I think he might have also thought it was Bernardini. So he comes into the locker room and he picks me up, you know, and twirls me around in the locker room and he's screaming, "That's what I'm talking about, Bernie," you know? And that's the kind of thing that builds fierce loyalty because even somebody like me, like this was a guy who would whisper in my ear every now and then when we were doing 3-on-2 to coach me without like, you know, making me nervous or anything. You know, like, he cared. And Kim Anderson cares deeply about his players. I believe that the ones that have the right mindset want to do anything they can to improve their situation. The question, again, is pressure. You know, is there enough mental toughness, which the 2016 that I was on unfortunately didn't have enough of. Is there enough mental toughness to block everything out? Because we won that Kansas game and lost 6 in a row, you know, and went to Baylor, you know, and got dunked on by a walk-on. You know, they were only allowed to play 12 games that year. And that was kind of it. Does this team with a more, I would certainly say Coach Anderson has, you know, a plenty of experience. I don't know if it was more experience or it's more, but I don't know if it's better experience. But does he have the ability to analyze what happened last year, which is a failure, total failure of leadership? And I think a stepping into a situation where you realize how difficult it is to manage egos. Like, you coach Division II for a long time and you get a lot of Division I transplants and they're humbled because this is the last stop. You know, you come here and everybody, 90% of the guys I played with thought they were going to play in the NBA.
Right.
Everybody thinks they're going. And how do you manage that? And do the players themselves have that fierce loyalty, basically, and the mental toughness to improve enough to overcome that pressure? I hope so. I have reservations. I think the younger players, given the chance, will be the guys that set the foundation. Will they do enough to convince people long term? That's, you know, I don't know. I make movies.
How much of big time college basketball, and you've talked a lot about kind of the other aspect of it, but how much of it is we just have these players that are good enough, and how much of it is all these things? Like, Kim has admitted he didn't really know everything that went with the job, and like you were talking about the confidence and all of that. How much of it is, hey, we just have really talented guys, and how much of it is all the other stuff?
Well, I think you see the idea of really talented guys play itself out with Frank Haith's last team. You know, Jabari Brown and Jordan Clarkson are on that team. Mm-hmm. That team didn't make the NCAA tournament. And it can't just be really talented guys,
right?
Because if they don't like each other, and I'm not a huge chemistry guy. Like, I believe in it to an extent, but you also have to have players, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have leadership and you don't have the ability to game in and game out, have mental toughness to overcome, you know, a really grueling sort of schedule. Like, I don't understand how the NBA does it, because playing 30 right. games is really difficult against good competition is really mm-hmm. difficult. That's it's has to be both X's or a combination of X's and O's, a combination of talent, and then a combination of selflessness, a sort of ability to understand your role, play your role, and adhere to your role, and play within yourself for everybody around you. What I have concerns about as a program is, like, what's the identity? What do they do? Mm-hmm. What are they trying to accomplish? With Mike Anderson, like, I had all sorts of issues sometimes about, like, why are we running the set every now and then? But we had an identity.
Right.
We you know, this is who we are. And, yeah, is it a mistake to run Matt Lawrence 7 times in a row, the shooter double screen baseline play? Like, probably. But at least we know what
right.
we're doing, you know.
Right.
And does this team have an identity and a point guard that can help establish that identity? Mm-hmm. I believe Wes Clark's a really, really good player. Is he a good enough leader? Can he play within himself enough? Is Terrence Phillips ready to be a guy who can help establish an identity? Because if you watch that team last year, you're going, like, what do they do? They run a lot of sets, but why? They don't have mm-hmm. a good point guard. Well, we can't run any back-to-basket stuff because we don't have a traditional back-to-the-basket reliable scorer. So what do we do? And will they start to form that identity around pieces that are in place? Because there are good pieces. Naaman Wright's a really good player. Mm-hmm. Jakeen Gant could be a really good player. Do they have an identity, and do they have enough dynamic athletes? I think there are some good athletes on the team. There are sometimes, though, some of those teams, when it's talented teams, it's also that not just skill talent, it's sometimes they're just overwhelmingly athletic. And that can make
and
up for a lot.
Kind of want to wrap it up with you talking basketball with this. My thought is, this team, everybody says, we got to see progress. I don't know if progress is a certain number of wins. To me, progress is, okay, I'll give you North Carolina, Arizona, and Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Those teams are going to blow you out of the building. Mm-hmm. Other than that, there can't be down 20 to Vandy and A&M
sure.
and Ole Miss in the first half.
Sure.
That's how I define progress. How would you define it in 6 months?
100% the same. They won 9 games last year.
Which is hard
to win. I mean, again, like, I want Kim Anderson to succeed. Mm-hmm. You can't win 9 games at Missouri. The job's right. too easy. I mean, it's a hard job in many respects, but it's a very easy job. I was on a bad team that won 12 games and beat
right.
Kansas and Oklahoma on the road and beat Oklahoma mm-hmm. State. Like, that team's 12-16 mostly because of the pressure of maintaining. You know, mm-hmm. like, we knew at a certain point, there's a really funny moment where an anonymous assistant is sitting around in the room with the managers and the other staff members. And he says, guys, here's the deal. We've got this pink elephant in the room, and everybody wants to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wants to pretend like it's not there. And I'm telling you right now, if things don't get better, I'm sitting around outside of an RV next year, throwing beer cans at kids walking down the street, yelling at them to get the Kansas scout tape ready. We're trying to deal with all that pressure. And meanwhile, this elephant's in the room, right? And you want to pretend like it's not there. And guess what? It's taking a dump on your head and it's saying you're fired, you know? And, like, that's real. That mm-hmm. exists. So we won 12 games with all of that in our path and beat some good teams. They won 9 games last year, and we're close to beating a couple of, you know, like Oklahoma State's a good team.
Right.
Are they going to be better? Yes. Will they win more than 12 games? The schedule is really hard. It's really, really
hard. But by the same token, they almost have to.
They almost have to. It's, again, also Missouri fans' expectations are legitimate and on point, I think. They shouldn't expect to win every year in and year out less than 14 or 15 games. Like, you right. The ceiling or the basement is 500. And if you're at 500, you can accept that. If you're a game under, you can, because of a transitional year. You got to be able to just, like, win enough to say, because that's ultimately how it's measured. It is measured in wins.
Right.
So I don't know. I, as a basketball person, as someone who understands it, would measure it the same way you might measure it, which is maybe they only win 11 games, but they play a lot better because the schedule is way tougher, and they're playing a lot of their younger pieces late that are getting really good. It's I don't know. I'm willing to be subjective about it. I don't know if other people are.
Right. And we'll see at the end of the year. And for people who I've been told sometimes when things go badly and I get snarky, I'm fun to follow on Twitter. Nick is fun to follow on Twitter during Missouri basketball games. So if you would either like to do that or find out more about the film and your career, where do they find you?
It's at Nick Berardini. So N-I-C-K, B as in boy, E-R, A-R, D as in dog, I-N-I. Not Nick Bernardini. I'm not Bernie. I love Coach Snyder to death. I still am not sure if he thinks it's Berardini or Bernardini. It doesn't matter. I love him.
That's all. Go out to Salt Lake City sometime and ask.
I'm going to ask him. Yeah.
All right. Well, Nick, appreciate it, man. Great stuff. And good luck with everything again. November 18th, Missouri
Theater. Yeah, November 18th at the Missouri Theater.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Nick Berardini, former Mizzou basketball player. No N in the last name, just so you know, and appreciate his time on the podcast again. Missouri, Mississippi State, 8:00 tomorrow night. Didn't talk a lot about it here, talking a lot about it on the website, and we will be back next Thursday previewing Mizzou. And Nick, who do they play next week? Any idea?
Football?
Yeah. I don't know either. It's okay.
Wait.
They play again next week, and we're going to talk
Tennessee?
About it. BYU.
BYU.
Mizzou and BYU and basketball. Basketball is going to open the season next Friday night. Trust me, we'll be caught up by then, and we'll talk all about it.